Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight where Dr. Arthur Laffer makes her first up appearance at the Sydney Institute all the way from Nashville, Tennessee. He's been brought to Australia by the Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industry, and we thank John Osborne and the staff at ACCI for making this talk possible in Sydney tonight. I'll introduce our speaker briefly because he's well known to you. He was an advisor to both Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher. He's identified with the Laffer Curve. He is the author of many books and papers, the most recent book I suspect being The Wealth of States, but many others. And tonight he's going to speak on the topic of stimulating economic growth through tax reform. Dr. Laffer, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's lovely being here, by the way. I just adore Australia. This is my fourth visit, and I've got to tell you, it's just every time it gets better and better, and I just love it. Thank you for having me. I want to start off today. There's another book I've just written this year as well, which is equally as fascinating as The Wealth of States. The Wealth of States is amazing because we have 50 states in the United States, as you may know, and constitutionally, there can be no barriers amongst the states. And yet each state has its own economic policies, taxation, spending, welfare, all of that. So we have 75 years worth of data, 50 states. It's just amazing, this cauldron of experimentation. And I take you through some of that today, but you know how the outcome is. And I hope I'm not going over your heads on this today. If you have two locations, A and B, if you raise taxes in B and you lower them in A, producers and manufacturers and people are going to move from two. I mean, that's economics. And the other book I finished this year is The Handbook on Tobacco Taxation, Theory and Practice, which is a big... There's no product on earth that's been more taxed, more... It's just a fascinating field for an economist to really see what the responses to taxation, I mean, what the responses are and how things work. And I'm very proud of that book as well, which is equally as sort of insightful into how people respond to incentives. On a personal level, some of you may know I lived in California for many, many, many years. I was on the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors there, which is a part-time thing. It was Schwarzenegger. And when he turned to the dark side, I moved. I told him I was out of Dodge, and I left, and I went to Nashville, Tennessee. Now, can any of you guess why I went to Nashville, Tennessee?
Music.
No. But I do like the music, but there's no income tax. Did I mention there's no income tax? Isn't it fun? I mean, I paid for my house with my first year's tax savings. Now, I did miss California. I did. I especially missed Schwarzenegger. He's a witty, interesting man. In fact, first time I really met him, I met him, said hello a number of times, but never sat down with him. Just before he became governor, I was invited to have breakfast with him at his home up in Los Angeles, which I went up and saw him. And having heard all these stories about his just penetrating wit and his aggressive style and conversation, I decided that my best defense was an aggressive offense. So when I went up there, I told him how ecstatic I was to meet him, to see him, to be with him. And that when I heard his primary advisors were Wilson and Buffett, I was just amazed. I was over the moon with delight. I mean, he had Wilson and Buffett as his advisors. And then when I found out it wasn't Owen and Jimmy. When I found out it was Pete and Warren, and he goes, ha, ha, ha. And a little bit later in the conversation, like a couple seconds later in the conversation, he looks at me and says, also, why are all you clear thinking economists so short? I mean, seriously, where does that come from? He says, no, no, awesome. Milton Friedman, he can't be more than 4 feet, 6 inches tall. Little bitty, tiny man. And he said, you also, you remind me of Danny DeVito. You know, I starred with him in Twins. Ah, well. I left California, went to Nashville, got my free house. It was fun. What I want to talk to you about today is a little bit of mixing politics and economics, if that's all right. Politics is where the sort of where the rubber hits the road. In the U.S., the politics has been moving very much in our direction. You'll be very pleased to note we had our elections in November. The pro-growth agenda, people in the U.S. By the way, it's not always Republicans. It's not always Democrats. It's not always liberals. It's not always conservatives. It's not always left-wingers. It's not always right-wingers. Economics is all about incentives. And whether you're tall, the incentives work. Whether you're short, the incentives are fat, skinny. I mean, incentives matter. And again, I hope I'm not going over your heads on this, but if you look at these incentives, I mean, if you tax people who work and you pay people who don't work, do I need to say the next sentence to you? Don't be surprised if you find a lot of people not working. It's incentives. If you tax rich people, you give the money to poor people, you're going to get lots and lots of poor people and no rich people. People respond to incentives in the overall system. I mean, who ever heard of a poor man spending himself into wealth? It doesn't make any sense. Who ever heard of an economy being taxed into prosperity? Well, I'm going to go through that with you. We have the elections. We've had the elections. The Republicans, who this time happen to be the pro-growth party, picked up 9 seats in the Senate. They now control the Senate. A dramatic shift in events. The Republicans in the House, they are the largest number of Republicans in the House of Representatives since 1932. It's an unassailable majority they have, which will probably be in control for the next 25 years. Governors. The Republicans now have 31 governors in the United States. They picked up three net. They picked up 4 and lost 1, Corbett in Pennsylvania. The Republicans control the legislatures in 30 states. Democrats control the legislatures in 8 states, and 12 are split. So, I mean, all the way across, you're seeing a political revolution in the U.S. And it's from my standpoint, a very exciting revolution. I love it. I've been to this barbecue before. I can tell you what the outcome's going to be, and you're going to love it. But the two issues I want to talk to you about, which are the most exciting issues, number one, and I'm sure they have nothing whatsoever to do with Australia, but they're fun for me in the U.S., and forgive me for sort of boring you with some economic issue of places far away, but taxing the rich. That's a really big issue in the United States, and what they should do is how they should tax the rich. You with me on that? And the other one, which I want to harken back a little bit, is stimulus spending. And stimulus spending has always been a topic in economic circles, if you know Keynesian economics or classical economics. But it's never had a chance to sort of flourish and grab the soul of people. Until George W. Bush came along, we had the housing bill and we had the agricultural bill in 2007. Huge increase in spending to stimulate the economy. Then we had the stimulus package in 2008, the one I loved is, I don't remember our Secretary of the Treasury, a man named Paulson. We had this stimulus bill for $700 billion. 700 billion. It's stack them up in $1 bills, it goes back and forth the moon 3 times. I mean, you know, it's a lot of money. And they did that. Paulson was, the bill which would grant it to Paulson, would have granted Paulson the control over the $700 billion, was 4 pages long. And by the way, congressional bills are very little pages with about 100, 150 words. It granted him total control over $700 billion. He had to have it now. He was sort of out of breath. He was sort of like a 5-year-old in a scary movie. You've got to give it to me now. We're about to go over the ledge of the cliff. We can't have hearings on it. can't be debated and the thing. You've just got to vote on it today, do it, otherwise the end of the earth. You all remember this now, don't you? 2007. May I remind you of a little fun? I've been in politics and government a lot. I was in the White House from 1970 to 72 as George Shultz's right-hand person. I was the first one to go to China in 1970, as a matter of fact. I've been involved in this politics a long time. Whenever politicians make decisions, when they are either panicked or drunk, the consequences are rarely attractive. Now, after, of course, the George W. Bush huge stimulus spending, then Obama came in and did his own $864 billion. You all, I'm going to discuss that with you. I'm going to discuss the theory and what has actually happened. But first of all, I want to do tax the rich. I mean, this seems to be the topic du jour. We're all worried about inequality and all this sort of stuff. And what I want to do is just take you to the facts a little bit and then just pull back and just explain those facts. In the United States, we did not put in a progressive income tax until 1913. In 1913, we put in the income tax, the progressive income tax. The highest rate was 7%. Okay? Now, I want to say this to you. Before that, the highest rate was 0%. And in that context, I want to say, having moved from 0 to 7% on the rich, I will stipulate today, counselor, that when they raise the rate from 0% to 7%, tax revenues from the top 1% of income earners actually went up. Now, I will cede that point. But let me just say that within only 4 years, by 1919, we'd raised the highest marginal income tax rate in the United States from 7% to 77%. Use the war as a... Now, by the way, just so you know, we have the greatest data on taxes in the world. Governments love to keep records of taxes. I mean, this is sort of like us keeping records of chicken for dinner. I mean, they have beautiful records of where they get their money. So all of the data are widely available. Any economist can go through and look at these data at any time they wish to. Woodrow Wilson, after World War I, the big battle was on in the election of 1920 as to how we should do with the high tax rates. Now, the rest of the world kept all of their high tax rates. They did not do it. But the U.S. had this battle, which was fun. In 1920, Woodrow Wilson had his hand-picked candidate, the governor of Ohio, a man named Cox, was the Democratic candidate, and he chose his best friend as his running mate, a man named Franklin Delano Roosevelt. So Roosevelt was the vice presidential candidate in 1920. Cox was the presidential candidate on the Democratic Party. They wanted to keep those tax rates high to pay off the wartime debt. Warren G. Harding was the Republican nominee. Calvin Coolidge was his running mate. And they wanted to cut tax rates back to the pre-World War I levels. That was the battle. The Republicans won by the largest percentage ever in the U.S. And let me take you through the numbers here. They cut the highest marginal income tax rate. Now think of this. From 77% to 25%. Is that a good enough cut for you? The tax rate on the rich was cut to less than one-third of what it had been before. Tax revenues from the top 1% of income earners as a share of GDP. Now, this period in the U.S. history called the Roaring Twenties, tax revenues went up, dramatically up during this period, in spite of the rate being less than one-third of what it had been before. The tax revenues from the top 1% of income earners went up. And then, of course, we came to the 1930, where we had the biggest tax increase on traded products. That was called the Smoot-Hawley Tariff, signed into law by Hoover in 1930. Economy in a tailspin. What happened to this rocket surgeon, Herbert Hoover? He, in January 1st, 1932, raised the highest marginal income tax rate from 25% to only 63%, small increase just to help along. They were having a little problem with revenues. And, of course, we went right into the depths of the Depression, and the end of 1932 was the first trough for the Great Depression. All right, obviously, Hoover was thrown out of office by a landslide by Roosevelt. Roosevelt came in, he had the Bank Holiday Act of 1933, which some of you are into monetary policy. You'll love it, but I'm not going to go through it here with you. By the way, it was not sending bankers to Bermuda for a long weekend. That was not it. But Roosevelt had all sorts of problems with the economy as well. On January 1st, 1936, Roosevelt raised the highest marginal income tax rate in the rich from 63% to 79%, and it wandered on up to 83%. during the Great Depression, they raised the highest rate from 25% to 83%. I mean, it didn't stop. Is it any wonder it was the longest, deepest depression? We had another big trough at the end of 1937. Tax revenues from the top 1% of income earners, if you look at these numbers, they raised the rate from 25 to 83%. Tax revenues from the top 1% of income earners fell as a share of GDP. The economy tanked for all 10 years. And by the way, it sounds familiar today, just so you know. You then go through, we had World War II, we went up, I'll take you to John F. Kennedy. Kennedy cut the highest marginal income tax rate in the United States from 91% to 70%. He put in the investment tax credit, accelerated depreciation for write-offs. He did the Kennedy round tariff negotiation, which lowered tariffs and trade barriers. Kennedy also cut the corporate tax rate from 52% to 48%. He tried to cut it to 46%, but thank God Barry Goldwater and Bob Dole didn't let him do that irresponsible act. So he had to back up there. The Republicans were the tax increasers back then. Now, if you look at that period of Kennedy, guess what happened to tax revenues from the top 1% of income earners? They went up as a share of GDP. We had the go-go 60s, they went up. Then the next period we had in U.S. history was what I like to refer to as the Four Stooges. It was Johnson, Nixon, Ford, and Carter, which was the largest assemblage of bipartisan ignorance probably ever put on planet Earth. Every one of them raised taxes. I mean, you remember the wage and price control, the tax surcharge by Johnson. That just doesn't stop. Tax revenues to the top 1% of income earners, flat to down during that whole period. Stock market crashed. It went to one-third of its... In 66, the stock market was at 1,000. In August of 82, the stock market was inflation-adjusted 250. How's that for a crash in the market? And then... Excuse me, is there any water on... No, I'm joking. The skies opened. The sun shone forth onto the planet. The fields, they turned green. The animals flourished in the fields. The trees bore fruit. The children danced in the streets. And Ronald Reagan was nominated and elected. And we cut taxes. And let me tell you, we cut taxes. We cut the highest marginal income tax rate in the United States. We cut it from 70% to 28%. Is that a good enough tax cut for you? We cut the corporate tax from 46% to 34%. By the way, always with the support of the Democrats were always with us in this, by the way, and they really were. In fact, we didn't have majorities at that time, and they all voted with us. We kept going tax cuts. I mean, anything that swam, we cut its taxes. If it flew, we cut its taxes. If it sat there, we cut its taxes. If it crawled, dug holes. I mean, we cut tax. 1980, personal income taxes, the top 1%, their total tax revenues from the top 1% of income earners as a share of GDP in the U.S. was 1.5% in 1980. In 2006, after a binge of tax cuts through Clinton all the way through, I mean, Clinton did cut taxes a lot, by the way, not on personal income, but on everywhere else. If you look at that, in 2006, tax revenues from the top 1% of income earners had gone from 1.5% in 1980 to 3.2% of GDP in 2006. Let me just tell you, all other groups, when you cut their taxes, they pay less. When you raise their taxes, they pay more, but not the top 1%. And why is that? The top 1% are different than the rest of us. They're rich. They can hire lawyers, accountants, deferred income specialists, congressmen, senators. I mean, when you see a group of people hanging with Obama, don't think for a moment these people are street people trying to explain to the president what it's like being poor. That they're not. They're people in there asking for favors, and they usually get them. They switch from government to Goldman Sachs. Not Goldman Sachs. Just using. I mean, they're all just traders. I mean, that's what they do. Rich people can change the location of their income. I moved from California to Tennessee for tax reasons alone. Poor people don't do that. I do it. You know, rich people can change the timing of their income. They have IRAs, KEOs, 401ks, all of this stuff. Rich people can change the composition of their income. Rich people can change the volume of their income. And they do. When you change tax rates on rich people, they respond. They do respond. So all of this debate about raising taxes on the rich is a fatuous debate in my mind, to be really honest with you, in the U.S. Whenever you raise those taxes, this is the battleground for the 2016 presidential race, is what type of taxes do you do? I could go on in this topic, but that's the one topic I wanted to hit with you first. The other topic I want to hit with you is stimulus spending. And I want to hit it with you in a little bit of an academic way, so forgive me for doing that, but you've heard all the Keynesians around. And let me, if I can, describe. When you look at the size of stimulus spending in the U.S., our total stimulus spending adding up, and forgive me, I'm maybe a million here, a million there off, but total stimulus spending, that is not just regular government spending. This is spending above and beyond what the government normally would have spent to stimulate the economy. All right, this is not paying for police, fire, and all that other sort of stuff. This is just, woohoo, have a party, guys. Stimulus spending added up to about $3.75 trillion. Total federal taxes during this period were about a little less than $2.5 trillion. So stimulus spending in this period from 2007 through, let's say, 2010 would have been about 1.75 years worth of total tax revenues. Just to give you a flavor of the sort of the getting the metrics, getting you sort of how to range these numbers. Now the logic goes, and I'll give you how Larry Summers described it. He said, look, and have all of you had education in Keynesian economics, haven't you? And I'm just going to go through it with you, and I want you to make sure I'm not missing it, because I went undergraduate to Yale, I went to Stanford, got my PhD, I was a great Keynesian economist, a little short, but other than that, not too bad. It's not funny. The logic is, if you give a guy $600, that guy will have $600 more than he otherwise would have had. And he'll spend part of that. That in turn will create jobs, output, employment from the people he's now hiring, who otherwise would not have been hired had you not given him the $600. You with me on that? Those people that now are hired who wouldn't have otherwise been hired have income that they otherwise would not have had this and that guy not been given $600. That with that higher income, they spent more than they otherwise would have spent had they not had the job and not had the income. And that in turn will create more jobs, more output, more employment, and there'll be a cascading effect through the economy as the economy sort of lifts itself up from the bootstraps. Do all of you see what I'm describing here? By giving a person $600, that person will spend more. That will create jobs, output, employment, higher incomes. Those people will spend more, and there'll be this cascading effect. Now, the way you look at it, the initial amount is the stimulus spending. If you look at the final amount, that'll be the final amount that GDP is raised by this spending. That'll be divided by the initial amount. That'll be the multiplier. For those of you who are a little nerdy, the multiplier is 1 over 1 minus the marginal propensity to consume. And that's how the economy does it. It takes off. If you want to see this, this is Larry Summers' lecture in London. But if you read anything, any textbook has it just this way. You follow me? I mean, am I describing it correctly to you the way the Keynesians say it? If you look at Jared Bernstein's book with Ruth Romer, it's exactly the way they do, and then they go and they get a measure of the multiplier, then they see how much goes in. This is the $864 billion that Obama put in. They multiply that times the multiplier. That gives the increase in GDP that occurred. They then spread it over the different quarters. That gives the increase in output, employment, production during those periods. They then translate it into the unemployment rate, and blah, 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 all, using Oakland's law, and it all comes out. You all with me? Now, as far as Larry Summers goes, he then goes and sits down. That's the end of the lecture for him. Now, as far as he goes, he's correct. It is true. If you give someone $600 that person otherwise would not have had, that person will spend more than he would have otherwise spent. That will, in turn, create more jobs, more output, more employment, higher incomes. They'll spend more, and there will be cascading effect. That's all true. But it's not the whole truth. It's the partial. It's the first chapter in a 3-chapter book. Now let me, if I can, go with you. It is very true that the people who receive the stimulus spending, they are stimulated, they spend more than they otherwise would have, and that creates a chain of increases in income, demand, output, and employment. That's all true. But you know, unfortunately, the tooth fairy no longer works at the U.S. Treasury. We live in a double-entry accounting world. The government doesn't create resources. The government redistributes resources. So every time the government uses funds to bail someone out of trouble, they also put someone else into trouble. There is the transfer recipient and the transfer payer, or the taxpayer. Now, the transfer recipient is stimulated, but the person from whom those resources are taken to give to the others, those people now have $600 less than they otherwise would have had. These people, in turn, spend less than they otherwise would have spent. That, in turn, disemploys people who had heretofore been employed, but now no longer have jobs because the people who lost the money are no longer buying goods from them. With their incomes down, they spend less. And there's a cascading effect on the exact opposite side, on the other side of the transaction, that exactly offsets the first effect. Now, this came to us in economics through an economist, a French economist named Léon Varrat, great economist. It came into the English language with Lord Hicks in his book Value and Capital. If you read that, brought that in the first 110 pages for those of you who are sort of geeky and love that. And what you know from Varrat is that they went back to the Slutsky equation. The Slutsky equation is whenever you change a price, the income effects in a closed in a total system, the income effects always sum to zero. While the transfer recipients have a positive income effect, the transfer payers have a negative one. Those two effects always sum to zero. The example Varrat used, I love, is if the price of apples rises, it is very true that apple growers will have higher incomes, they'll be wealthier, and they will spend more. But it's equally as true. If the price of apples rises, apple consumers will be poorer, they'll have lower incomes, and they will spend less. These two effects offset each other by the hour, by the day, by the week, by the month, by the year, to the 5,365th decimal place. There is no stimulus in stimulus spending. While the transfer recipients are stimulated, the transfer payers are destimulated, and those two effects offset each other. If you have an economy of 100 apples produced, if the government takes 10 of those apples and gives them to people based upon some characteristic other than work effort, the people who had the 100 apples now only have 90 apples, and those income effects there. Are all of you with me on that? Now let me take you to the bad chapter, the chapter you're not going to like if you're a Keynesian. And you're not going to like it if you're a human, because they did it to you. While the income effects of the Slutsky equations in an economy always sum to zero, the substitution effects don't. The substitution effects aggregate across. Let me give you the example of Varrat. If the price of apples rises, while those who grow apples are richer and have higher incomes, and those who consume apples are poorer and have lower incomes, for everyone, the higher price of apples will reduce their marginal incentives to consume apples, for everyone, rich and poor alike. And for everyone who produces apples, the higher price of apples will incentivize them to produce more. All the substitution effects work to greater production of apples. All the substitution effects work to lower consumption of apples to bring you back in equilibrium. All of you with me on the substitution effects? And I was trying to explain this, that the same thing is true with regard to transfers. With regard to transfers, the substitution effects all work against higher output, employment, and production. They all work to destroy the economy. I had the worst time with Senator Nelson from Wisconsin. It was 1974 or something. Jerry Ford had just done his whip inflation now, which included a tax rebate. And I was in congressional testimony. I was with Otto Eckstein, Paul McCracken, and Gardner Ackley. They were all, of course, loving this sort of tax rebate. And I, of course, did not. And I was trying to explain the substitution effects to Senator Nelson, and I got frustrated. It was hard. I didn't know how to do it. And finally, I said to him, I said, Senator, if those three other economists are correct and this $600 stimulus thing is going to help us, what in the heck's wrong with you and those people in Congress? Don't you love our country? I mean, if you love our country, why stop at $600? Let's have a boom. I mean, don't just do $600. I mean, do $6,000, $60,000, $600,000. Do $1 million. Do 100% of GDP. Let's do a stimulus package equal to 100% of GDP. So everyone who works and produces receives nothing, and all those who don't work and don't produce receive everything. Senator, what do you honestly think would happen to output in this country? And of course, it would go to zero. When you look at stimulus spending, it's just what common sense would comport. You can't trade something out of nothing. While the income effects sum to zero, the stimulus to the transfer recipient is positive, the stimulus to the Stanford payer is negative, but the substitution effects guarantee that you will have less output, less employment, less production. Now let me take that to today's world. In today's world, we had stimulus spending in the U.S. of $3,750,000,000,000. The reason why it is the Great Recession is because of our stimulus spending, not in spite of it. It is the government's response that caused the Great Recession to exist, just like it did in the Great Depression. I took you through the tax rates in the Great Depression. I've taken you through stimulus spending here. In all honesty, the stimulus spending and quantitative easing, which I don't have time for here with all of you, but someday I'll go through quantitative easing. It again shows how American economists, except for a couple at the University of Chicago, how American economists don't understand double entry accounting. They don't understand you can get something for nothing. No, you can't. There ain't no such thing as a free lunch, as my colleague Milton Friedman put it. As Milton Friedman put it every single time, government spending is taxation, pure and simple. So the reason we had that, you know, what you're seeing today, and I'll just, these are the two of the key issues that are in the debates in the U.S. politics. I don't know whether these are important here in Australia, but I guess they might be. You know, this is the battleground. This is where the whole political sort of nexus is coming together. I'm going to leave you with a little fun, is that in my opinion, I've been to this barbecue before. The first time I was at it in the late 70s with the real president, I had no idea what it was. It smelled great, but I had no idea what. Now I know what it is. I used to tease the real president, and forgive me on this. I used to tease him that I said, "Sir, you know, it is my professional judgment as an academic, as a professor, as a PhD economist. It's my personal judgment, sir, that you truly are a certifiable genius." But some of my colleagues at the university don't concur in my assessment of your intellectual acumen, sir. Some of my colleagues actually don't think you're very bright at all. But the one thing my colleagues and I do agree upon is that your one unique characteristic is your uncanny ability to select your four predecessors. Anyone following Johnson, Nixon, Ford, and Carter just can't look bad. You just can't. And let me just say that I was with him in 76, and if Reagan had been elected in 1976 as president, you would have not seen the same president that you saw. In all truth, it took Jimmy Carter to create Ronald Reagan. It really did. And in the same breath that it took Jimmy Carter to create Ronald Reagan, you can't believe the great president who is going to follow Barack Obama. And with that, sir, I think I hit my time right on the button.
Now, do you want a glass of water or not?
No.
No? Okay. All right. So thanks to Clayton Yutz for the use of this facility this evening. And again, thanks to the Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industry, ACCI, based in Canberra, for bringing our speaker tonight to Australia. And thanks to John Osborne and the team at ACCI. So we come to questions and discussion. We'll finish sort of at the top of the hour, because I think you've got a plane to get. So just finishing up where you left off, Ronald Reagan's of great interest to so many people. And it's now some time since he was president, of course. We had a successful Prime Minister here, Bob Hawke, who ran a good Social Democratic Labour government. But Hawke has said that he liked Reagan, but he didn't think Reagan was very smart. He said that when he spoke to Reagan, Reagan had notes and crib points and whatever. I mean, on the other hand, if you read Reagan's personal correspondence, he comes across as a very perceptive man. How did you find him to deal with at a personal level?
He, at a very personal level, he was a love. I never saw him lose his temper. I never saw him behave improperly. He was just a delightful man to be there. He had a great sense of humor. I could tell you tons of stories. Can I tell you my favorite Reagan story? It was right after Grenada. Do any of you remember Grenada?
Yeah.
Now, I am not a political military guy, okay? I'm not. I'm just a boring old dull economist. That's what I am. I'm not into social issues and all that, but I'm fascinated by military political stuff. And this was right after the U.S. sent troops to Grenada. The commies were there. Cuban troops were there. It was mano a mano, Americans shooting Cubans, and they were shooting back at us. And I mean, it was the first time in generations that American troops had met in a battlefield against communist troops. And I was really excited. Now, he and Mrs. Reagan used to fly back to California quite frequently. This was the old guy. My godfather, just so all of you know, my godfather was a man named Justin Dart, who happened to be Ronald Reagan's best friend. That's how I got to be so closely associated with Ronald Reagan. I used to tell everyone the way I got so closely associated with Reagan is he had a lineup of economists from all walks of life, and they were all standing there in the podium, and he said, "I'll take the little short fat one over there." But that would be a lie if I really told you that. I earned my stripes by privilege, and it's really much easier that way than it is. So they used to come out, and he and Mrs. Reagan would go up to the ranch, Rancho del Cielo, and he'd chop wood and ride horse and do all that. And they'd fly down in the hot helicopter to the Century Plaza Hotel. Do any of you know that? The curved one there in Century City. They have the annex in the back, which is a square building. The top two floors are the presidential suite. They'd land the helicopter there, and then he and Mrs. Reagan would have their suite there, visiting all the old friends, He'd have a group of us young kids come over. Before they went to dinner, they all went to Chasen's, which was our sort of restaurant du jour in Los Angeles. And he had this one thing. There were about three or four of us there, and Mrs. Reagan didn't have a lot of time for us, but he enjoyed us. And he was there, and it was right after Grenada, and I just had to find out what happened. And he had his little gin and tonic. I guess they call it a screwdriver. You can't really tell. I mean, he felt a little good, but you can't smell it or anything. And I went and I cornered him. I said, "Sir, you've got to tell me. How did you make the decision to go into Grenada? You got to tell me. How did you do it? 1 minute it's no, the next minute it's yes. Sure, in that 2 minute interval, sir, you didn't get enough new information to push you over the edge. You got to tell me. How did you make that decision to go into Grenada?" And he looks at me with this thing. "Well, Art, I just asked myself, what would John Wayne have done?" And if you think about it for 1 second, it's the right answer. You don't go to pollsters and you don't go to these other people and ask, "What should I do? What should I do?" You imagine what a script writer would write for the guy with the white hat. If you're going to be the hero, what is the script the hero would actually... And that's the way, I mean, it's just amazing. It was the right decision, the right time, the right place. I could spend the rest of the evening here with you on great stories, but Reagan was the real deal. He was not pretentious like most professors. He didn't cry like Hawk did. Did I miss that somewhere? Reagan didn't go, "Oh, it's so tough, I've got to be..." No. Reagan tried to handle issues very clearly, correctly, clear-eyed, and went ahead and did it. If you go through Reagan in His Own Hand, which was written by Marty Anderson, you'll see exactly what you say. Thousands and thousands of personal pages of a man really contemplating and understanding and working with the world as it is, not as we'd like it to be.
Right, so there's a question here, then we'll go here, then we'll go here. Yes?
Thank you, Dr. Laff, for your presentation. I carry this around to remind people what the end game of the U.S. current U.S. policy is, a $20 trillion Zimbabwe note.
Isn't it lovely? I've got a larger one if you'd like to trip. I've got a 1 trillion or something.
This is 20.
Oh, 20 trillion. You've got mine.
But you spoke of tax and spending policy, but there is a slight difference to what's going on today than what happened in the 80s, because Janet Yellen and Ben Bernanke are not Paul Volcker.
I know.
And that's the real problem in the system. So can you make some comment on that?
Yeah, I would. It's a whole different topic. I mean, but whenever you push a price of a product below its equilibrium price, interest rates, which they have done, you are met with a conflict. You have to have a theory of the allocation of frustrations. Now, we know what happens at equilibrium. It's where the demand curve hits the supply curve, and both the demand curve and the supply curve give you a quantity, both the demand curve and the supply curve give you a price, and you understand the price and the quantity. But when you push a price below the equilibrium, like they have done, you have to have a theory of the allocation of frustrations, because you don't know whether that price will operate at the supply curve or at the demand curve or somewhere in between. But we do have ways of analyzing that. We have a theory of we have a linear programming. And in linear programming terms, you know the operational constraint is always the first constraint. That stops it. For example, if you have colon cancer and you're going to die in 3 weeks, but you jump off the top of a building and hit the cement is the operational constraint. Cancer didn't get you. So when you push interest rates way down, Janet Yellen would argue the reason they do, we do that is to stimulate the demand for housing. But unfortunately, with low interest rates, you never make it to the demand for housing. Because what happens is the low interest rates hit the supply curve first, and no one's willing to lend money for mortgages. So the reason we have the horrible housing market is because interest rates are too low and because there's no mortgage money to fund people buying houses. If they ever would allow market rates to come back up and hit the equilibrium, you'd see a boom in housing like never before. They don't understand there's a supply curve and a demand curve. It's not all demand, Keynesians. There's a supply curve. And if no one's willing to supply mortgages, you're not going to have anyone buying houses.
Then we go to John. Okay.
Does that answer your question?
Yes.
There is a new theory, whatever, that things have changed since the 80s, that more and more and more voters are dependent on government for handouts. And this then affects the way in which people will vote. Is this going to be a problem for this kind of economics to come back into focus?
It's always a problem. I mean, it always is. But, you know, people who receive handouts aren't proud of their receiving of handouts. I mean, I think people who would much rather have a job than have a handout. I mean, the way John F. Kennedy, who was my first, I've worked with Democrats more than I have Republicans historically, so forgive me. But I mean, John F. Kennedy put it precisely. He said, you know, the best form of welfare is still a good high-paying job. And there's only one way of getting that, and that's economic growth. In the same sort of venue here with Kennedy, which I love, as Kennedy put it this way, he said, no American is ever made better off by pulling a fellow American down. And we're all made better off whenever any one of us is made better off. And the one line we stole from Kennedy in our campaign was the next line, which is, a rising tide, it raises all boats. And that's where we are now. I think people are sick and tired of handouts. They're sick and tired of not having jobs. They're sick and tired of not having a growth economy. They're sick and tired of... We have the single worst recovery in U.S. history. Reagan's was the single best recovery in U.S. history. So I think we're all set in the politics. We'll still have a lot of people who will never like Reagan, will never like the next president either. But I think the country's going to come back really strongly.
John.
Dr. Lathy, you make a compelling case that America is due for a great presidency, which is exciting. We're a year and a half out. There's a couple of dozen people whose names have been floated as potential candidates. Who would be the top two or three people that you think could be the next Reagan?
I don't know if I should say this on TV, but I'll say it anyway. Politicians are different from most people. You know, and let me put it this way. I describe it humorously as politicians are people who had bad mommies. You know, your mom instills in you in early childhood a set of values, a set of, you know, a compass. You know when you've done a good job. You know when you've done a bad job. You don't need someone else to tell you. Mom put that in you. Politicians didn't have that same sort of compass put inside them. So they always look to external approbation to get a confirmation of their worth. You know, they always look to... That's why politicians, a lot of them have affairs. It's not that it's the sect. They want someone... I love you, I love... That's why politicians look in mirrors all the time. They do. That's why politicians spend days on end dressing. I mean, if you look at the... If you, any of you go to YouTube and look at John Edwards' I Feel Pretty, you can see you've never seen a badly dressed politician. They have perfect suits. Reagan's tie, look, I mean, they're pretty amazing. I mean, you know, if a politician gives a speech and everyone boos, they change their speech. So they're perfectly suited for this type of environment, which is an election. So we have a process that takes all of these wonderful people, and I know all of them, and they're all fine, qualified, fine people, And what you do is you throw them into this process. And they go, they fight around for money, for comment, for votes, for certain. And it goes to this sort of Paris Island training process. And one of them pops out at the end. That one's going to be very well trained. I cannot tell you which one that one's going to be. But I know the raw material there is great in all of them. And you're going to get a great Republican candidate running for president in 2016. And it is because of this process. So therefore, you shouldn't try to preempt the process and guess which student's going to get the highest grade. That's not what a professor should do. What you do is you put them through a course and then give them a final exam and let the chips fall where they may.
You're going to get someone with a bad mother, right?
Maybe they were orphans.
Orphans.
Maybe they were
now
orphans.
Now we're going to Sri up there, then we're going to go to Lynn down there. Yeah, okay. Speak up.
The level of prices or inflation hasn't responded as much to quantitative easing as we would predict. And usually the strongest argument against printing money is inflation. I was wondering what your explanation is and whether there's any evidence that we're going to
I don't have a... the question is, yeah. Wouldn't you have expected a lot higher inflation after all the quantitative easing and the printing of money? And yes, I would have. In fact, I wrote a great piece in the Wall Street Journal I was really proud of, and it was totally untrue. I was wrong, and more wrong. And why did you have to raise that question? You're just trying to embarrass me. But no, I was wrong, and I seriously was wrong. I don't know why we haven't had more inflation. But I don't want to Monday morning quarterback you and pretend I now have the right answer. I don't.
Lynn.
Much has been spoken of the compression of the middle class. Could you comment on that and what might be done to address it?
Yeah. Question about the compression of the middle class.
Compression of the middle class. That is a great sound to it. Compression of the middle class. I wish I could take your accents home with me in Kentucky. You know, we talk about wallflowers and them things over there. You know, compression of the middle class. What you say, Dr. Laffer? Excuse me. But I love it. It's a compression of all classes. Everyone's been doing badly here. I mean, maybe there are a couple that do well, but bottom line, if you look at the black teenagers, if you look at black teenage employment as a share of population in 2000, right after Clinton presidency, they had about 30% of black teenagers were employed in 2000. That compares with a little over 50% of white teenagers. That compares with a lot higher number of black older people. So, you know, these kids are really hammered in the world. I mean, they really are hammered. You worry about the inner cities and all that. At the bottom of the Great Recession, black teenagers had less than 15% of their population employed. From 30 to 15. That's a 50% reduction in employment. That's way more. Everyone else has suffered a lot, too, including middle class. But I want to focus you on the black teenagers. I mean, when you look at these kids, these poor kids, you know, they can't find a job. After being unemployed for a couple of years, they become unemployable. They learn to live in their environments, God knows how, without a job, without the income. After being unemployable for a couple of years, they become hostile. And then you have to protect yourself from them. You know, this is the whole sort of series of consequences coming to America's future. Some of these kids may be lost forever. It is a tragedy beyond belief. This is not a joke. This is not a political game to play. These are honest to God, real human beings. You've seen all the stuff going on in the U.S. and that. It's a tragedy, and it's not the police's fault. It's not these kids. It's the people who run our government who have not done the pro-growth supply-side economics to create the jobs, output employment, to bring these people into the mainstream, to allow them to have lives like all the rest of us have. So that's where I go is the compression of all classes that occurred. If you look at total employment as a share of population, we went at the end of Clinton with 64.5%. It dropped down to 58.5% right away in the Great Recession, and now it's at 59%. There has been no improvement in the U.S. If you look at GDP relative to trend, we're $4 trillion off trend. This is the worst single recovery ever. It has been a catastrophe. Reagan's was the best single recovery ever, following the greatest drop in the economy. I mean, we really fell off a cliff in both the early 80s and also in the 2006-7-8 period. So, you know, this is a compression of all Americans, and it's a tragedy. But it's not just middle class, and I you know, again, it's for everyone. But I really, my heart goes totally out to the poor, the minority, the disenfranchised, and the men. They don't deserve this. They don't deserve having an economy that exploits them the way it does. Well,
got a question up here. Yeah.
Yes, I've got a question about polarisation. There's a reasonable argument that Australia has become more polarised, and it's sort of a distant observer of the US. It appears as though that's happening, and there's actually active campaigning against people who work across the aisle. I think that's the American terminology. Is that a reasonable view of America, and is that causing problems?
I couldn't have paid you for a better question.
Is America becoming more polarised?
Well, I don't know if it's becoming. It is about as polarised as you can possibly get. There has not been a bill that's been bipartisan in a long, long time. You know, it really hasn't been. Now, let me tell you, this is not the first time that's happened in U.S. history. If you go back to the 70s, why, I tell you, I've been to this barbecue before. It was just like that back then, in the 70s. And then when we won the election, we had this economic growth and the tax. The Democrats, once Reagan did the pro-growth agenda, all these redistributionist polarized Democrats who controlled it back then, Dan Rosenkowski, Tip O'Neill, all of them back then, all of a sudden the polarization stopped and a lot of Democrats bolted and became part of the new growth majority. Let me give you an example of how the coalescing and the rejection of polarization occurred shortly after the extreme polarization of the 70s. We had a bill called the 86 Tax Act in the U.S. All right, this bill cut the highest marginal income tax rate in America from 50% to 28%. Big cut for the fat cat rich. You with me? 50 to 28%, the highest marginal income tax rate in the U.S. was after this. In case we missed a few of the fat cat rich, we wanted to make sure we didn't miss, that we wanted to get every one of them. So we cut the corporate tax rate from 46% to 34%. Just in case we missed a few of the fat cat rich and those who we made fatter, we wanted to make even fatter after that. And then what we did was we actually raised the lowest tax rate. That'll teach you to be poor. We raised the lowest rate from 12.5% to 15%. Now all of you know this is not what we did. This is my joking thing to it. What we did was we lowered the highest rates, raised the lowest rates, moving towards a flat tax. Yes. And in addition, what we did there was we got rid of all these deductions, exemptions, exclusions, such that this tax bill was exactly revenue neutral. Reagan said, if it's $100 tax positive, I'll veto it. If it's $100 tax negative, I'll veto it. This is not a tax bill. This is a tax structure bill. All right? We took it from 14 tax brackets down to 2 tax brackets, 15% and 28%. That's what we did. We passed that bill in 1986. Guess what the vote was in our polarized Senate? I could do the House vote with you too, but it'd take a long time. Guess what the vote was in the Senate? Can you imagine that bill today here in Australia? Can you imagine it in the U.S.? No. I mean, you can get no votes. The vote in the Senate in the U.S. that 1986 was a very close vote of 97 to 3. 3 senators voted against it. Simon from Illinois, Melchior from Maryland, and Levin from Michigan. Those were the only 3 voted against it. All the rest of the Democrats voted with us all the way. Mr. Lefty Wefty, Alan Cranston from California, he's with us all the way. My next door neighbor and dear friend, Al Gore, he voted for it. We had Mr. Death Tax himself, Howard Metzenbaum from Ohio, he voted for it. We had Tall and Pink, Bill Bradley, he voted for it. We had that senator from Delaware, what was his name, Joe Biden, he voted for it. We had Chris Dodd from Connecticut, he voted for it. Teddy Kennedy, for God's sakes, voted for it. In the House, we had Barbara Boxer, she voted for it. We had Harry Reid in Nevada, he voted for it. We had Dick Durbin from Illinois, he voted for it. We had Charlie Rangel vote for it in New York, and Chuck Schumer in New York also voted for it. Why did these people vote for it? Because it's the right thing to do. They know they're wrong today. All of this polarization stands in place of thinking it's gotten to be polarized because people are. You're going to see all of this politics unpolarized very shortly. You're going to see the Democrats working with the Republicans, working for a better America together. And they'll be very clear thinking that you cannot tax an economy into prosperity. Did you get that? And poor people can't spend themselves into wealth. It's stupid.
And we're running close to the end, so we've got to be very quick. Ross, do you?
Dr. Laffer, just wondering, my sense in the Australian environment is that in the public narrative, attachment to high taxes for the rich is almost the sort of emblem of a person having an evolved conscience.
Yeah.
My feeling is we're losing this argument. Do you have a sense of optimism or pessimism when you look at the sort of Western world thinking on economics?
Australia, I can't talk to you about. There's a lot of this same thing that you're describing in the U.S., which you refer to as the fall of conscience. I consider it an atavistic, cerebral response. You can't love jobs and hate job creators. You know, rich people, you've got to treat like customers. You know, when I have someone who's my customer, I treat them, I love them dearly, I love being paid by them. The government is paid by rich people. They're the ones who pay the taxes. They should be treated with dignity, respect, and graciousness. They shouldn't be considered, throw them into jail, we hate them, they aren't paying their fair share. I mean, that's disgusting, divisive types of conversations, to be honest with you. Tax codes that work, work through voluntary compliance. It's not that you don't get a couple of cheats, you do. But that's not the way the system works in general. The system works is through a social contract of all of us together with voluntary compliance from all sectors. I don't mind paying more in taxes as long as everyone else pays their fair share too. But when you have tax rates at these very high, oppressive, confiscatory rates, they're disgusting. And everyone knows they're unfair. Everyone knows they're punitive. Everyone knows that the government hates rich people. And that's not the way to run a country. You need them. In fact, the dream is to make everyone rich. The dream is not to make the rich poor. The dream is to make the poor rich. And once you get this notion that we're all in the same tub together, guys, we're all here, make your tax codes fair. If you make 10 times as much as I do, you should pay 10 times as much in taxes as I do. You should. But you got to make it where people feel it's fair, it's decent, it's correct, and that they're getting something for what they put in that system. And I think it's just about the end of this redistributionist, hostile, negative, selfish world of income inequality statements of Piketty's, of Krugman's, of these people. They're just about done. And it couldn't happen to a better group of people.
There's a question there, but it's got to be quick. Yep.
When I was studying...
No, got to be quick, okay?
Yeah, when I was studying over 30 years at Supply-Side Economics, my university reference papers...
Okay, you got to get to the point.
Dr. George Perry, you said, I quote, "Austerity is not the solution. People is the solution," end of quote. Could you explain further...
So the suggestion is austerity is not the solution, people are the solution.
Yeah, so people are the solution, people respond to incentives. And if you make work attractive, people will work more. If you make leisure attractive, people will take more leisure. People respond to those incentives. And that's exactly what the government could do. It should do the following. It should have, number one, a low-rate, broad-based, flat tax. You want to collect your taxes in the least damaging fashion. Spending restraint. Remember Milton's edict, government spending is taxation. Low rate, broad based, flat tax, spending restraint, sound money. There's nothing that can bring an economy to its knees faster than unsound money. Low rate, broad based, flat tax, spending restraint, sound money, free trade. We should have free trade. And then finally, minimal regulation. Everyone knows we need regulations. Everyone understands that. You can't wake up in the morning and decide which side of the street you're going to drive on today. But what you want to make sure happens is that those regulations go to the specific purpose at hand. And don't have collateral damage on the side that was unintended. Low rate, broad-based, flat tax, spending restraints, sound money, free trade, minimal regulations, then get the hell out of the way and let the economy take care of itself. Yeah. Period. That's what we're going to get. Thank you very much, everybody.
We had many more questions, but no more time. So many thanks for coming along. And because we're in a hurry, and our speaker's got to get a plane to Melbourne, I'd just like to say to Dr. Laffer, thanks for a wonderful performance and an entertaining performance tonight. And we'd love to have you back sometime in the future. And thanks to Aki. Well done. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.